NBA, the Bucks beat Detroit 115-105. The Bulls lost to Brooklyn 122-117. The Bucks are off tonight. The Bulls play in Miami. The NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They're off again tonight. College basketball, the number 24-ranked UW Badgers beat Nebraska 62-51. Tonight, number 10 Marquette takes on Butler. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday the 30th. The wind chill warning stays in effect until noon tomorrow. Today, mostly sunny, continued bitterly cold, patchy blowing snow through the day, a high of 12 above, winds up to 20 miles per hour, wind chills between 42 and 52 below. Tonight, clear and bitterly cold, overnight low minus 25, wind chills between 39 and 49 below. Thursday, sunny, 50-50 chance of snow, continued very cold. Thursday's high, zero. Wind chills between 38 and 48 below. Here are the current numbers now just in. Wind from the west at 15. Sunshine, blue sky. Actual temperature, 22 below for Racine and Kenosha. Wind chill, 45 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway grads can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available online at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.
I count among the greatest pleasures of my life, the opportunity that my wife and I had to visit the beautiful city of New Orleans. And we did so actually not long before that city was devastated by Hurricane Katrina and the floods that followed. So I feel especially fortunate that I got to see New Orleans in a sense in more pristine fashion in its original beauty. Well, New Orleans is still there. Still hanging tough, having rebuilt itself courageously in the wake of that catastrophe. And New Orleans remains one of the most remarkable and distinctive cities in the United States, and with one of the most distinctive and unique histories of any major American city. Jason Berry knows that better than probably anyone alive. New Orleans is home to Jason Berry, and he is an award-winning writer who has just written a marvelous book about his city called City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. You might very well know Jason Berry for other great work that he has done, including one of the most important books about jazz called Up from the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II. And perhaps you know his hard-hitting reporting on the terrible story of priest abuse of children. And his probably best-known book on the topic is his book called Lead Us Not Into Temptation, Catholic Priests and the Sexual Abuse of Children. In this latest book, Jason Berry explores the remarkable history of the city that he calls home, and I'm very honored indeed to speak with Jason Berry about this book, published by the University of North Carolina Press, again called City of a Million Dreams. Jason Berry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, for that generous introduction.
I really am happy to be speaking with you. One of my favorite lines really leapt out at me, and not just because I'm an opera fan, but just because it's such beautiful writing. You write at one point, the city opened into a series of adventures in which its identity kept shifting, like a great diva changing costumes in a succession of operatic roles. I wanted to begin there because I should think that nicely encapsulates the huge challenge that you were undertaking in trying to write a, at least somewhat succinct history of such a complicated city with such a complicated history. Tell us more about kind of the dimensions of the challenge that you undertook with this book.
Well, I should begin by saying that my wife, Melanie, who did her doctorate in Nabokov, said just about the same thing that you just did. I was taking on quite a challenge. I wanted to capture the essence of the city in a way that previous histories had not done. I wanted to explain, both for myself and the readers, why has such a beguiling personality. You know, the masks of Carnival, one tragic, one comic, seem emblematic. And what I found in drawing on past research and in doing a great deal of new research is that the character stems from a long tension, a culture of spectacle rooted in the early dances of enslaved Africans at a public park, and a city of laws that for most of our history was anchored in white supremacy. So I chose distinctive characters in each era of the historical timeline, people whose lives and deaths held a mirror to the shifting patterns of daily life. And in doing that, I had to make a lot of choices, particularly about what to leave out. And I was determined not to get too obsessed with generals and politicians. I did have to include some of them, some of the key ones. But largely, it is a story of culture pushing against the law.
Hmm. You made an interesting choice in terms of where to begin your book. It begins with a memorable day in New Orleans, November 20th, 2015. An important event in New Orleans set against the backdrop of something, at least for the most part, completely different that was playing out. So tell our listeners, first of all, about this important event that you wanted to begin your book with and the context within which that event took place.
Sure thing. Well, I should say that I was well into the writing of the book, and I had my thematic architecture, as I've just referenced for you, when Alan Toussaint, the great rhythm and blues composer, died quite unexpectedly in Madrid after a concert. He was the composer of a great many memorable hits, Mother-in-Law, Lipstick Traces. He worked for a range of artists, Paul Simon among them, as a producer. So when the body came back for the funeral, it was in the Orpheum Theater, an elegant theater that had just reopened after Hurricane Katrina, long years after Katrina. And that funeral, which was so illustrious, almost like an affair of state, coincided with the furor that was building over Mayor Mitch Landrieu's decision to take down four Confederate monuments. And it really dramatized the very concept of the book. So I felt in a way that God had smiled and given me an opening for my historical narrative. Toussaint's body, or I should say the coffin, came through the theater with the various musicians intoning the slow, solemn movement of the dirges, the sorrowful song of death, with a pounding boom of the bass drum, and the musicians came outside into the splashing sunlight with so many people now gathering behind the coffin, and as it went into the hearse, they sent up an up-tempo ringing clarion of a song as people began dancing and celebrating the soul's release from earthly ties. This is pretty much the structure, the pattern of the jazz funeral. And one of the musicians who was there that day, a guy named Glenn David Andrews, who's a swaggering trombone player and singer, He comes from a family with 10 other siblings or cousins named Glenn Andrews. I don't know why that is, but it's like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez dynastic story. And he put up a tweet, and he said, take down Robert E. Lee, the Lee Circle, and put up a tribute to our hero, Alan Toussaint. And, of course, this went viral. There were opinions going back and forth on social media. And to me, it really captured the tension between culture and the law. The Robert E. Lee statue had gone up after Reconstruction as a symbol of white supremacy. Well, you jump ahead four or five generations or more, and it was part of the cityscape. The St. Charles Avenue streetcar went around the high column with Lee top with his arms folded, looking toward the French Quarter. And I think to many of us who are white and grew up here, it was simply part of the landscape. But as Wynton Marsalis, the jazz man, said to Mitch Landrieu, I wish you'd take him down because I don't like seeing him up there, and many people like me don't like that either. So it crystallized, that moment sort of crystallized the issue of the Confederate monuments, which I take up and deal with in the last chapter.
Right. And I think that's a story worth returning to maybe towards the end of our interview. And it probably says a lot in particular about New Orleans specifically. I want to make sure that I clarify something. Explain to our listeners exactly your personal connection to this city.
Well, I'm a native of New Orleans. I grew up here in the 1950s and 60s, going to carnival parades, having my whole sense of place shaped by this spectacle of grown-ups wearing masks and costumes and dancing in the streets, which tends to plant a certain optimism for the human experiment. I graduated from Jesuit High School. I went on to Georgetown University and then got my start after working in Mississippi in 1971 for Charles Evers, a civil rights leader who ran for governor. And I wrote a book about that experience, and at the age of 24 had the luck, I guess I should say, of being a published author. I had no idea how hard it would be as a freelance writer over the succeeding 40 years or more, but that's my background.
You're listening to the interview I recorded with Jason Berry, talking about his most recent book called City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. 2018 marked the 300th anniversary of the founding of New Orleans, and Jason Berry's book is not only a thorough retelling of that city's colorful history, but also a series of vivid portraits of some of the most colorful figures from New Orleans history. And chief among them is the man generally credited with the founding of the city, Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne, Sieur de Bienville, who at the tender age of 17 joined his older brother Iberville in an expedition exploring the coastal areas of what we now call Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And it was actually Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne who actually proposed to the powers that be in France for a particular location to be the location of a new community that would be the capital of this French colony called French Louisiana. And that community, of course, was New Orleans, officially becoming the capital of French Louisiana in 1723. Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne, in that first expedition with his brother, followed essentially the path of an earlier explorer, La Salle, and that path took them into many encounters with Native Americans in the area. And they both became very much acquainted with and appreciative of Native American culture. And as a matter of fact, one of the most distinctive things about Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne was that at some point he decided to cover his body nearly head to toe in Native American style tattoos.
We don't know at what point exactly he had his body inked with snake tattoos. But in 1720, a French admiral in a journal remarked upon these, you know, serpents covering his skin. Body art of this kind was quite common from the First Peoples, First Nation peoples, as they are now called in Canada, all the way down to deep Louisiana. The Indians emblazoned themselves with all kinds of images to demonstrate bravery. There were even crosses, crucifixes, stars, the moon, animals. The body became an advertising medium for the exploits of the brave, of the man who had his body inked in that fashion. And so Bienville, who was hardly alone among the European explorers to do this, wanted the Indians to see that he could fight as fiercely as they, and indeed he could. He was like a character out of a Joseph Conrad novel. I mean, at one point, he's having this battle with the Natchez Indians, and he corrals the chiefs. And the Natchez, 250 miles upriver from New Orleans, where the city of Natchez is today with its red bluffs, were a kind of empire with an emperor whom the people believed to be a deity close to the sun. He managed to capture these guys in a remarkable military feint, which would be a little complicated to go into on the air. Nonetheless, there are these guys, these Natchez royalty, in a tent, and it's steaming hot, and Bienville is telling them, "I want the heads of the men who murdered these French voyageurs, explorers." And you know, the image of this guy with his own tattoos, you know, bellowing at these chiefs, telling them, you know, we must have eye for an eye justice, is really quite striking. He had the support of Count Pontchartrain in doing that, and indeed they brought him the heads of the killers. He managed to secure the food chain in New Orleans with help from peaceful area tribes, particularly the Choctaw. And by the time of his departure, going back to France in 1743, he had successfully grounded the city, and it had not been attacked by Indians. In fact, it never was attacked by Indians.
One of the things that gives New Orleans, especially in these early years, sort of a particular sort of flavor is kind of this, in a sense, mix of ownership and displacement of one owner for another, but also this this idea of people from France being dumped in this region as punishment. Can you tell us something about that? First of all, how much of that is grounded in reality? I mean, certainly it happened, but to what extent it was significant, or is it something that is kind of taken on the stuff of legend? And in to what extent did that have any significant effect, in a sense, on coloring the whole kind of personality of the region in and around New Orleans?
I have to compliment you. That's one of the most intelligent questions I've ever been asked in a radio interview. Let me see if I can unpack it with some brevity. When the colony was getting underway, the French crown had entered into an agreement with John Law, who was a fly-by-night Scottish financier who was brilliant and not exactly anchored in honesty or probity. But he created a national bank to assume the crown debt, selling stocks. So everybody was investing in this beautiful new world with all these lavish descriptions in the French press, some of which were factual. One of the things they did was literally abduct people from prisons prostitutes, particularly criminals. There were enforced marriages before some of these people got on boats. They were taking the dregs of French society, if you will, putting them on boats and sending them to the New World. So, you know, Bienville himself was rather upset with the quality of people that were coming into the colony. There wasn't a lot he could do about it. He kept writing letters asking for good French women to come and begin families with, his soldiers and roughhouse pioneers. One of the reasons they did that was because the church was complaining that many of the French Canadian trappers and French soldiers were bedding Indian women, sometimes in common law arrangements. Other times they were taking Indian women as slaves. It was a real raw, roughhouse society. It was a sexual hothouse. There's really no other way to describe it. But when you throw people from disparate backgrounds into this wild, into a raw wilderness at the bottom of America, people scrape to survive and people seek human intimacy. In any event, while those numbers were not enormous, it was not, 6,000 and 7,000 people out of prisons, but they were in the high hundreds. Nonetheless, the impact was to establish the city as both a sort of elegant outpost of the French crown by virtue of its early architecture, and same a place with a multicolored and fairly raucous society.
Hmm. I think you quote a writer from the day saying, "This is a country without religion, without justice, without discipline, without order, and without police." I suppose that could probably be said about quite a number of sort of outposts of the Old West as well. But something about the way that that state of affairs came about in New Orleans is maybe somewhat unique.
I would agree with that on both counts. You have to remember, though, that the Company of the West, which John Law had formed after the French economy crashed and Law fled to Venice, the company was in a sense left holding the bag, and they continued making the investments in the city. But by 1729, when there was a revolt of Natchez Indians and a massacre at the French colonial outpost there, the company withdrew, and New Orleans was thrown back under the aegis of the crown, which had never shown great interest in funding it in the way that the Spanish did in the late 18th century after Louis XV pretty much handed the city to his cousin in the Bourbon monarchy, Carlos III of Spain. It was the Spanish who really put a great deal of money into the city, particularly after the terrible fire of 1788. What you have between these French and Spanish monarchies and how the city was governed was the emergence of a Creole sensibility, Creole meaning born in the New World, that also included the enslaved Africans, many of whom by the time of the Spanish were able to purchase their own freedom. And what emerged was a tradition of black soldiers, free men of color, who had a role in the defense of the city and would eventually play a greater role in the Battle of New Orleans.
Hmm. When we hear about the Creoles, one of the names that comes to mind from your book is one Antonio de Sedella, a friar who really is a colorful figure as well in the early history of New Orleans. Would you like to say just a brief word about him and his place in this city's history?
Well, he was known as Père Antoine. Even though he was a Spaniard, it's in fact kind of typifies what the city was like, that you have a Spanish Capuchin friar, Antonio de Sedella, who is known as Père Antoine. because the city was still largely French, even under the Spanish administration. He came initially as an agent of the Spanish Inquisition. And the idea of the Spanish Inquisition, you know, sending an investigator to New Orleans, even now, I guess, evokes a sense of comedy more than it did then. But the governor at the time, Esteban Miró, did not like him because he felt his power was being threatened by this law and order cleric who apparently, or so it seemed to Miró, wanted to gain access to the private homes of these French planters and to inspect their libraries and determine if the books were on the forbidden list or if they had any of these works of Enlightenment thinkers endorsing free will and other poisonous concepts. And so Miró, 5 years into his stay, had him arrested one night and deported. It took 5 years, but Sadea, who loved New Orleans, managed to get an appeal to the King of Spain, won a reversal of his ouster, came back and made New Orleans his place in the sun, as so many other people have over time. As Père Antoine, he turned into a great liberal, if you will. It was a sort of right-to-left shift, in a sense. He welcomed slaves and free persons of color to the church that soon became St. Louis Cathedral. He would marry almost anyone, regardless of their different faith backgrounds. And this is during a time when the city under Spain was really a theocratic state under Carlos III, who was known literally as his Royal Catholic Majesty. And canon law was one part of the governance, and Spanish law another. After the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, when New Orleans becomes an American city, Père Antoine continued in his powerful position as the pastor of the main church and served as a spy for the Spaniards. I mean, he was getting a regular salary for this, letting them know everything that he could find out. He set himself up in a hut behind the great church, and all day long people would go there for counseling, and he was really a folk hero of his time. Twice the Vatican tried to get him removed, and each time he sort of fomented demonstrations against the visiting bishops who soon left town, realizing that they couldn't get rid of the guy. Really quite a remarkable character.
To say the least, one of many you highlight in your book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jason Barry, and we're talking about his book called City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. The book does a remarkable job of talking about the history of this unique city and some of the unique, colorful characters who are part of that history. It seems to me that one of the characters in your book, although not a person as such, but in a sense something that plays the same sort of role, is a place in New Orleans once known as Congo Square. Could you explain to our listeners what Congo Square was and just how incredibly significant it was in more than one respect?
Yeah, Congo Square, as it was actually the last in a succession of names in the early 1800s. Originally in the mid-1700s, it was known as Place de Negre by the French, Negre meaning of Negroes or blacks, and then Place du Congo later in that time period, because it is where Sunday after Sunday the enslaved Africans would go, initially for a makeshift marketplace where there mushroomed these dances, ring dances, which we know from, Sterling Stuckey's magisterial book, Slave Culture, that everywhere the ring dance was performed, a memorial movement in homage to the ancestors. These were burial choreographies. Africans buried their dead in circular dances meant to convey the seamless pattern of a cosmos in which the living and the dead and the unborn were bound together. This was the African worldview. The dances grew larger, and the historical accounts I have drawn on, some of which are remarkably descriptive, convey the way in which cultural memory powered the African-blooded peoples in the city, who had been, of course, brought there most against their will, and it was the cornerstone, if you will, of a culture of memory and ritual that was destined to grow and expand, particularly by the time the European carnival celebrations of the 19th century it became a way in which the African people could demonstrate their own ideas of what celebration was like in the dances, the music, and the way in which costumes came to define a certain dynamic in Black cultural patterns. So Congo Square really is sort of hallowed ground in the city's history. Today, what is left of it is contained in Louis Armstrong Park in the Treme neighborhood. But in the early 1800s, it was a vast plain just on the other side, a grassy plain, just on the other side of the rampart, which was the wall separating the city proper from the outback, so to speak. And we know as many as 500 people would dance at a given time with spectators, some of them white, some of them free people of color, drawn to this spectacle Sunday after Sunday. And the roots of the music were so polyrhythmic. What you find at the end of the 19th century is the emergence of jazz as African polyrhythms march into European instrumentation and melody.
I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about two women who are two of the colorful characters on which you throw a spotlight. And I think having just described the wonder and color and spectacle of Congo Square, this is a fairly nice segue into the legacy of Mother Catherine Seals and Sister Gertrude Morgan. Tell our listeners a little bit about both of these remarkable women and why they merit the place of prominence that they have in your book.
Thank you. Mother Catherine Seals was an illiterate faith healer who founded a center in the Lower Ninth Ward, was called the Manger. She had enough wherewithal through her earnings to buy land, to put up a fence, and to take in pregnant girls who were unmarried, women who were fleeing violent husbands or companions, children, and sometimes families who were, in economic straits. She had this large field of several acres and built a temple for worship, a large tent area where jazz bands would come and play. She herself was a trombonist who played in the band. Several of the musicians who got their starts at the Manger went on to substantial careers, notably Ernie Cagnoletti, a trumpeter who was quite well regarded at Preservation Hall in the 1960s, and Harold Dejean, who was the founder, or I should say, who led the Olympia Brass Band from roughly 1962 until his retirement in the late 90s.
Jason Berry, in his book, goes on to explore the remarkable life and legacy of one Sister Gertrude Morgan, born in 1900, who died in 1980, who lived and worked not far from where Mother Catherine Seals did her important work with the Manger. Sister Gertrude Morgan was a self-taught African-American artist, musician, and preacher, who at one point saw a vivid vision of herself as the Bride of Christ, and this vision powerfully affected her for the rest of her life. Her folk art has become actually quite coveted in the field of folk art, But there is even more to the story than Sister Gertrude Morgan herself.
What struck me was her relationship with Larry Bornstein, her art dealer. She meets him in 1960 in the French Quarter, and he is a founder of Preservation Hall, where traditional New Orleans jazz is having its rebirth right in the middle of the Freedom Rider demonstrations. I mean, the city is kind of a political cauldron. And here is this woman with these visions of the New Jerusalem and herself as a bride of Christ. And Larry Bornstein, he had been thrown in jail three times in Mexico for antiquities out of the country. He's a very crusty fellow. And daughter helped me enormously. She gave me access to the letters he wrote to her mother. Both of the parents, you know, are deceased. So I had access to his love letters when he was courting the woman who became his wife. And I'm convinced that his proximity to Gertrude softened him a bit. And he ends up selling her work in a great many places. And then the day finally came when she said to him, "I'm sorry, I can't paint anymore." And he was dumbstruck and asked why. And she told him that the Lord had told her it was time to stop. So what must resolve itself in heaven must resolve itself to earth. She stopped and lived another 8 years. But I found in her an essence of Mother Catherine and a sort of purifying presence in this city, which by that time was arousing from the cold slumber of segregation and moving into what we would call the modern era.
Hmm. One thing I learned about New Orleans from reading your book, among many things, but one thing that was kind of unexpected to me, I've always thought, most people have thought of New Orleans as being uniquely distinct from the rest of the United States. I mean, and we've already been highlighting some of the kind of the unique ingredients in its history, which has led it to become such a distinctive place. But your book, among other things, makes clear that even in Louisiana itself, New Orleans is in a sense distinct from the rest of the state, and certainly very much distinct from the state government there. I mean, I think you say at some point about how maybe only one person from New Orleans has ever been elected governor of Louisiana. So even in its own state, Louisiana stands in a sense very distinct and very apart. Am I overstating that, or is that true?
No, I think you're being very kind in the way you put it. many of the upstate legislators from evangelical and Pentecostal communities view New Orleans as a Babylonian outpost of sin. And, of course, today the city has a great deal of crime and drugs. A lot of that is because of the long neglect of urban policy, as you find in other parts of the country. But no, there's been a long tension between the city and the rest of the state. In fact, after Hurricane Katrina, when the city was literally on its knees, I mean, barely gasping for air, the legislature did very little to release emergency funds to raise the kind of money it would take to rebuild the infrastructure. They sat back and waited for the federal government to come in, which did eventually happen. But New Orleans was, I was quite fortunate. My house did not flood. 80% of the city did at an average level of 4 feet. And this is seven times the size of Manhattan Island. And although Katrina is now a distant memory for many people, I think most of us can remember those television loops with people on the rooftops, pleading for help to, helicopters overhead. Politically, the city is in a curious position because before the hurricane and in the last 8 or 9 years since Mayor Mitch Landrieu basically rebuilt the city with federal help, New Orleans has been the economic engine of the state. So as much as there is this tension with the legislature and certain upstate politicians, some of whom, as I say, view it aghast, nevertheless, it is the international city that draws not just commerce but an enormous local economy from tourism, because so many people are curious about the place and come here to see it because it is so different.
Has it rebuilt itself or recovered in a way that you expected? In other words, are you at all surprised by any aspect of New Orleans' rebound from Katrina?
Yes, I would say so, because as recently as 2009, 4 years after the hurricane, when Mayor Ray Nagin finished his second term, and I should add, soon found an endowed chair in a federal penitentiary, the city was still in many ways a broken mud town. There were whole areas of the infrastructure that needed work. And, played the race card to get reelected and was almost off the pier. He did not need support from federal agencies. He had a relationship with other politicians. Some people speculate that he had a nervous breakdown during the hurricane. I think there is certainly some proof for that. The real question is how he functioned afterwards. He certainly thrived on national television appearances and I would say little else. When Landrieu got elected, Mitch had been the sitting lieutenant governor. He immediately went to work with help from his sister, Mary Landrieu, who was the U.S. senator at the time, in a federal pipeline to rebuild the city. And although there are areas today which is the worst flood, Ninth Ward, for example, is still a pretty fractured community, near as many people as lived there before, because few of them had insurance for the homes. Nevertheless, the city is in really remarkable condition. It has become a magnet for young people, a city of the young, not economy and a burgeoning film industry, but the restaurants keep drawing young people who are interested in careers, as chefs or in the front office. And although gentrification has occurred in some areas, with the tensions, that come with that, New Orleans, nevertheless, is the American city with the deepest African identity. It is a majority black city, and car, say, is the industry and tradition that it's a constellation of identity pageants. From the crew of Rex, an old line, this man who becomes king for a day, or the crew of Zulu, the African organization has become a political powerhouse as well. Many white politicians join because they know where the votes are. So every year, on the day before Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, Rex goes to the Mississippi dock to greet the king of Zulu as he steps off his boat. This is it's a symbolic meeting. It's in the middle of carnival season with dances and marching in the streets and very few people working downtown. But nonetheless, symbolism is important in the life of a city, and I think it does convey the attempts at racial reconciliation that have been ongoing and which I think many people here appreciate as part of the path toward a more prosperous and meaningful future.
Let's briefly return to a big topic we touched on earlier, namely the removal of Confederate statues from New Orleans, chiefly a statue of General Robert E. Lee. This was done under the leadership of former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, the son of a previous mayor of New Orleans, if I remember correctly. As this has played out, of course, it's played out over all kinds of different cities across the American South. How would you say this played out in New Orleans specifically?
Well, Landrieu had the advantage of the law behind him. You may recall in, in Richmond, for example, any attempt to put up a new statue or take down existing ones, you know, in the long neutral ground of, you know, Confederate monuments, with Arthur Ashe, the tennis player, also included, would have to come with state legislative permission. New Orleans put up the four monuments that caused so many problems in the late 19th and early 20th centuries by fiat of the city itself. One mayor, who was a former Confederate veteran, and a subsequent mayor took it on themselves with the strong support of the Daughters of the Confederacy and groups like that, to put up these memorials to Confederate memory without a plebiscite, without a referendum, without getting any input from the black community, many of whom had been purged from the polls. So when Landrieu came along at the urging of Wynton Marcellus to do this, his first move was to check the law, do the research, and he found that he was well within his authority, and got the city council to support the initiative. I think it was a vote of 6-1. So the city was well within its right, and the preservationists and people who opposed it on political grounds mounted legal challenges, which even the highly conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals determined should not impede the city in its own authority. So the city's authority was granted, and that's how he was able to take the statues down.
Hmm. How would you characterize the healing of, let's call them, the wounds that kind of erupted over that move?
Well, Mayor LaToya Cantrell, a populist who was elected last year, has taken a fairly deliberate approach, you know, advisory committees, things like that. I think she has not made a decision on what sort of replica will replace Robert E. Lee at Lee's Circle. My guess is that the statues of Lee, General Beauregard, and Jefferson Davis will probably end up in a cemetery on the outskirts of town, which is filled with Confederate monuments, or conceivably in some sort of public park. The lieutenant governor, who's a Republican, very much wants access to them to put in some, you know, state park. I think that will work itself out. I don't know where they will end up. The larger question is, what will the public space where Lee once stood look like? My guess is that it may return to a kind of fountain of some kind, along the lines of what it was like in the 1830s. But all that is yet to play out. Your question, though, when you ask about feelings, there are some folks locally who feel pretty raw about this, no doubt about it. But I think in the main, most people have just moved on. Certainly in the black community, there is a sense of some balance that has been restored. There are preservationists still smarting over the dismantling of those monuments. But I think in the main, the city as a whole is moving along. The great call came the other day by a call in the fourth quarter that brings deep disrepute to the NFL, but I do digress.
Well, on that note, we finish out what's been a wide-ranging conversation about a really impressive book. I read in one review that you were called a virtuoso of all genres because of the many different kinds of books that you have written, and certainly this book is superb in every respect. Again, City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300, published by the University of North Carolina Press, and the author, Jason Berry. Jason Berry, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I really enjoyed this.
Greg, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.